Welcome to episode 2 of CreateCast, the show about people who make good. I'm your host, Chase Kay. As always, we have a really incredible guest. Today we're talking with Steve Staley, a voiceover artist who's worked on a ton of different stuff. Movies, TV, video games. You actually might recognize him from animes like Bleach or Naruto. He plays the character Neji on Naruto. And you may also recognize his voice from video games like Final Fantasy or even Castlevania. Needless to say, this is a really, really cool interview, and it's a great little look inside the world of an actor, and, you know, more specifically, the work of a voiceover artist, which is very similar in a lot of ways, but also very different, and I think something that not a lot of people know about. At the end of the interview, I'm also going to be playing one of Steve's animation demos, which is sort of a fascinating, kind of fast-paced look inside what it takes to be a voiceover artist. He'll go through a variety of personalities and characters all in the matter of, you know, a couple minutes, and it's really something to hear, so stick around at the end of the interview. As always, the three magic words: rate, comment, and subscribe. So make sure to rate in the iTunes store, comment, show us some love, and of course, subscribe to the show so that you can hear from the rest of our incredible guests. Also, you can head to our website, createcastpod.com, to check out behind-the-scenes photos and more info about the show, and also sign up for our email newsletter so we can get you some more exclusive content. With that out of the way, let's get straight to the interview. Once again, today's guest is voiceover artist Steve Staley, and this is a really fun conversation, so let's get to it. Hey everybody, we're here with Steve Staley. He's an incredible voice actor. He's worked on everything from Naruto to Star Ocean, we were just talking about, and Bleach, and just, I mean, a ton of stuff. And man, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show.
Awesome, thanks. Glad you wanted to have me on.
So let's just start right at the beginning. Where did you first, you know, sort of get into acting or voiceover, and how did that begin?
Well, I moved out here after I graduated high school to go to college. I went to Chapman University down in Orange, California. Go Panthers. And I moved out here to be an actor. I had always done plays and singing in choir ever since I was a little kid. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I don't know, I thought about the road less traveled. There were other interests that I had, but I was intrigued by the possibility of doing something more challenging, I think. There's also a element of narcissism in it, I suppose, when you're a teenager and you're heading out to Hollywood to pursue the big time. But as much as that, I was already an artist. I was a singer, dancer, actor, you know what I mean? And so I moved out here, went to college, and then I moved up to Hollywood after I graduated to start doing my thing.
I guess that sort of makes me wonder, you know, obviously it's not a thing that a lot of people choose lightly. That sort of, that, you know, sort of the creative life, you know, whether it's an actor or a musician, because it's difficult. Were there any sort of influences that you can point to, maybe when you were in high school, where you maybe saw an actor or a movie and you said, wow, that's so cool, I want to do that?
Oh, I don't want to answer this question honestly, but to answer this question honestly, the things I say in these interviews and then they go, I feel like it's just human talking and then everyone hears about it. But the truth is, in high school, I was obsessed with Kirk Cameron. I think I was in love with Kirk Cameron, to be completely honest, but I wanted to be on a sitcom. I wanted to be like Kirk Cameron. This is 19-year-old Kirk Cameron, by the way, not grown-up Kirk Cameron. And so he was my prototype. I was like, I could be that funny. I could be on a sitcom. I could do that. And I thought, fuck it. I'm going to move to Hollywood and be an actor. But it wasn't impulsive. Like I said, I always have been in singing and plays and
just performing
arts. Yeah. So it wasn't like arbitrary. But the honest truth is, I wanted to be like Kirk Cameron. And so I moved to California. Isn't that a hysterical answer? But it's the honest answer.
No, I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, everybody, you know, it's one of those questions where it's like you ask someone what their favorite movie is, and it's always, you know, the stock response, and even I have it, you know, it's like, well, Gone with the Wind, or something just absolutely classic, but I think it's almost cool to say, like, well, no, it's just, you know, it's a
maybe like even if it's just a sitcom, it's like always so cool to see those sort of entertainment aspects where it's like more just about the fun of it, and maybe just about sort of that, like, able to bring joy to people.
Yeah, and I don't know, to a teenager, being on a sitcom, especially we're talking about the 80s, so there were nothing but sitcoms, really, and it just seemed like the funnest possible job on planet Earth. And on top of it, you get to be rich and famous, which I realize is a shallow and superficial thing, but it's undeniable, and I think people who pretend that that's not part of what they come here for as a teenager are liars. I mean, reality hits pretty quick, and you have to reconcile that, but initially,
yeah,
you know.
So, I mean, obviously, so you come up after college to go for the acting thing, and where does voiceover come into the picture?
I was working at Warner Brothers here in the neighborhood, actually, when I was 21, and this is at the beginning of what I guess I would call our modern age, the beginning of interactive cable TV, the beginning of personal computer explosion in games, and in a way that it is more reflective of what it's like today than it was from the early 90s to the past. And I worked for a company at the time called Warner New Media that was focused on making interactive CD-ROM content that was kind of nebulous, if I were to describe it. They were games, but they weren't games. Mm. They were interactive, like educational, but they weren't what we would recognize today, mostly because I don't think computers had the power to really create that kind of content. Anyway, that content all needs voiceovers. Almost everything needs a voiceover.
Yeah.
And so they knew that I was an actor, or, you know, a wannabe to them, I'm assuming, as a 22-year-old. And but they pulled me in when they needed young, enthusiastic
voices.
Whatever. I'm not really cartoon voices, but promo-esque, whatever. Anyway, I put some of that stuff together for them. You know, I would come in and record when they needed it. And then kind of thought, oh, some of these elements might be useful, or something that I could make a voiceover demo out of. And at the time, everyone I knew was an actor, everyone who I had graduated college with. We all moved up here, and so I was living with a couple of roommates who were also pursuing acting, and one of my roommates said, let's take a voiceover class. Which, at this point, that was 21 years ago. And so we took this class out of a woman's kitchen, which was awesome. We had a lot of fun. And it was during that class that I realized, oh, you know what? I'm good at this. This is really well suited. And then I look back at all the shit that I would do in high school and joking and voices and being funny and how applicable that all mimicry and how applicable that all was to the job of voiceovers. And so I began putting together a demo, just because why not, you know, sending headshots out, trying to do commercials, all that stuff, and was basically just expanding all my options. I hadn't yet decided that that's where I was going to put all my effort. And at that time, I was about 24, and although I had some stuff going on in my early 20s on-camera thing, you know, commercial auditions and all that stuff, it wasn't quite popping. But then when I started pursuing voiceovers, I got a little interest in a way that I wasn't quite feeling in on camera. Like, people were interested in what I had to offer. I would get return phone calls from agents, or I would say I get a phone call that said, come in for a meeting. And so it was at that point, I honestly think because I sort of was feeling the love, that I said, okay, I'm going to pursue this. Hmm. And then the more I got into it, the more I really, really put my effort into making that my career. Now, we could deconstruct that. I don't know if it had to do with because I was insecure about on camera, or you're suddenly this little fish in the gigantic pond of Hollywood. I don't know what, because you can also perceive being a big fish in the gigantic pond of Hollywood in terms of voiceovers. But I went for it. I guess that's the end of that cycle of my early 20s and how that ended up pushing me towards voiceovers.
So as you sort of get into that voiceover world, and obviously a lot of your work experience now has been in dubbing, which I think is sort of interesting because most of the time when I think people think of voiceover, it's like a specific, you know, maybe written for English part that then is, you know, for example, animated to the voice.
Right, original.
Working, yeah, when you're working in a dubbing environment, how does that sort of differentiate and also how do you sort of make it yours when you have to fit it to a pre-existing sort of, you know, image?
Well, first of all, dubbing, I would consider myself recognized for dubbing mostly because the properties in dubbing are popular. They're content that people watch.
Yeah.
Like, you would never necessarily think of me being well-known for commercial campaigns that I'm a part of because that's the invisible part of voiceover that nobody's thinking about. Shows are shows. People see them and they know who you are. There's also a lot of other aspects of voiceover. Industrial looping is a huge aspect of my career. All the things that are truly quintessentially behind the scenes voiceover stuff. But as far as dubbing as an art form, it takes practice is the answer to your question. And how do you make it your own is very difficult because it's not your own. And for the most part, when you're dubbing, the first thing you see is a preview of the original. Mm-hmm. And especially at the beginning of my career, it was very important to all the producers that I worked for that the that my performance be very much
In the spirit of
the original. And that is what that is, because ultimately when you're an actor, it comes down to someone else's money, and they've hired you to do what they want, not what you want.
Yeah.
And so you use mimicry, you use all your skills, offer line readings, hope that they match what it is that they're looking for. Often the line reading I love is the one the director doesn't love, and vice versa, and they're going to choose anyway, so it doesn't matter what I want.
You know, it's funny, I was just interviewing a poet the other day, and I was talking to him about there are these translators who translate ancient poetry. And this is like a totally nebulous connection, but there are these translators and they do these translations, and sometimes it's not, like, there are certain phrases or terms or words that don't have direct translations. And so it's often more about capturing maybe the spirit or the aura of a poem as opposed to the actual, you know, exact translation. And that sort of reminds me a lot of how you have to sort of maybe interpret what the, you know, previous actor in another language did and sort of reinterpret it in your own way.
Right. Given the parameters of lip flap movements and pauses that aren't necessarily related in any way to what the line is in English, which then you have to address the collaboration, which is this person who spent hours writing that script from a literal translation, taking into consideration how long a line flap is that in Japanese might take 4 seconds to say, but in English might only take 2 seconds to say, and how you pad that or how you take away and take into consideration all the technical aspects. And then the performance, you just have to learn how to give a fresh enough performance within the context of pre-painted cartoon, a finished product, really. Same with a video game.
And you were just talking about sort of also, you know, looping and sort of that commercial work and sort of the behind the scenes, sort of invisible, I think you called it. How maybe do you find that different, and how do you find that versus what you maybe initially thought? You said, you know, looking at sort of a sitcom actor versus how do you make it, again, sort of, I guess the question is, how do you make it yours when it is almost this invisible thing? Because I think it's so cool, and I think a lot of people often don't think about voiceover just as, like, a cool art form that, like, oh yeah, there's someone behind that voice making it and having to do this thing.
Right, that's actually a person that you hear in a movie doing the airport announcer role. That doesn't just happen. Honestly, how you make it your own is the skills involved in the performing arts. You make it your own because you've spent your lifetime learning how to control your breath and be a good singer, or standing up making fun of people, or joking around, or learning how to pull all of your skills together to create an effect or be somebody. And then when the moment comes and the downbeat occurs, you do what you know how to do. And that is bring life to a scream when you're doing a big-time feature film and you're the one putting the voice behind the guy getting machine-gunned to death. Well, that has to sound real, and you just figure it out.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think one thing that people really don't appreciate is sort of the effort that has to go into a lot of these sessions, because when you aren't being seen on screen, I mean, really all of the emotion, all of that really just needs to come from the voice. And obviously I've heard, you know, especially with, you mentioned video games, I understand those sessions can just be exhausting, right?
Yes, they are. which is why, for the most part, a video game session is only 4 hours long. Same with an original animation session is only 4 hours long, because at the end of that, you're taxed on a lot of different levels. So in video games and in dubbing, truly, it's taxing mostly because it's all on you. There is no dispersed energy, whereas like in looping, or if you're on the stage with other actors, it's not always you. It's up this one time it's this, and the next time it's this. But in a video game, it's only you in the booth. Your line, one after the other, after the other, after the other, making sure you're trying to get in hundreds of lines in a certain amount of time, all of which are different, and the connotation is different, the attitude, the meaning, the emotion behind each line is different. You got to come up with it on the spot. And so it's taxing. And then, of course, there's the obvious part of it that can be taxing, which is the vocal stress, vocal effort.
Yeah. So I went, take me through maybe a session. Like, let's say you get a script for a session, and let's say just a cartoon. It's an original character, and you're providing the voice. Where do you start to go to build that character's identity? What do you look for?
Well, I've started building that in the audition when I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do with it. And after this many years, what I say when I teach classes is you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You just have to figure out what you're going to do. So I don't necessarily create brand new every time. Mm-hmm. I draw on my catalog of strengths and apply those to whatever character they're asking of me. And also, in answer to that question, you have to consider in the professional world, nothing is being given to me that isn't within a certain range that other people have decided I am right for. So, for example, in anime, that's why I'm playing a lot of young characters, because not only is that a strength, it's also what everyone who's in the position of hiring actors perceives, and so that's what I get. So, to answer your question, it's narrower than you think.
Yeah.
It's not do an old man grandpa character, then a female character, and then the next thing a flamboyant character, and then a tough character. Although there is range within all of that.
Yeah.
It's much narrower when you get down to it in the professional world, because they don't need to hire me for those other parts. They hire an actual 70-year-old man or a gruff whatever.
Yeah.
So it comes down to casting.
Well, and as I also understand, you can, or at least in a session, it's acceptable for them to have you, I think, read for, isn't it three characters in a session or something like that? Or
I think that is a rule, that at work you can do up to three characters before they have to pay you more money.
Yeah.
Is really what it comes down to. Yeah. They'd have you do 100 characters if they're willing to pay the money, and if you've got characters. But that rarely comes up.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You're there to do your part. Maybe an incidental character in original animation, like on the original series that I've done, I've played my character, and then in a handful of episodes, you're the other incidental four-line, the other incidental four-line part, or something like that.
And that also just makes me sort of interesting, just the recording process. I know that certain cartoons or certain video games, they have maybe table reads, and also, you know, they'll have actors record at the same time. Like, I know with Batman the Animated Series, for example, often, you know, Mark Hamill and, of course, I'm blanking on the guy who voiced Batman, but they would do their sessions at the same time. Do you ever have that opportunity?
In original, it's often that. Like, in some of the original series that I've been on, yeah, we would all go into the same studio at the same time, like 10 of us, and we would... It was different every time. Sometimes we'd have a full read-through of the pages, and then we'd go in and do a record. Sometimes we would just go right into a record. But what you also have to understand is that in a 30-some page script, that a cartoon is about a visual. It's not really about the vocal, except that it is also about that. But when it comes down to amount of content you're trying to create, it's not that many lines. So even in a 30-some page script, if you're the featured character, you might only have 24 lines when you really get down to counting those lines. So in 4 hours of time, you're going to be saying each one of your lines 15 times, so they have something to choose from. And that's with everybody in the room reading it down like a radio play, or you read the whole script through like a radio play and then you go back to the beginning and read it through line by line, or you do it one page at a time or one scene at a time. They do it differently a lot.
Do you find that you prefer the sort of group sessions or the individual sessions? Or does it depend?
My honest and cynical answer to that is I prefer working.
Yeah.
So I couldn't care less, to be completely honest. Of course a group session is more fun because you're there with everybody else and everyone's there working, you're making money, so everyone's in a good mood, and it's fun, it's light, you're called upon to deliver artistically, but it's not like being in a trailer at 5 o'clock in the morning doing makeup and having to hold your concentration until midnight.
Yeah.
You're there for 4 hours. You have your job to do. You call upon the parts of yourself. You deliver what is asked of you in your lines, and mostly you hang out with everybody and have a good time. So original is way more fun when everybody is there. It can also get a little cacophonous if you're in the booth and everyone's trying to be a comedian and you're there to work, but they're different. Alone, though, going back to video games, it's on you. Every line is your line when it's just you. There is no your line and then 4 pages later your next line.
Yeah.
It's every line is your line, and it requires a lot of focus just to stay into it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think it's sort of interesting, and again, going back to that idea, it's, you know, because it is just the voice, it almost takes so much effort, and you were even talking about vocal fatigue earlier, and just sort of the idea that, you know, by the time you've said the same line, you know, 20, 25 times, it's got to be a little bit taxing.
You get used to it.
Yeah.
That's what the job is. And so you're prepared for that. That's what you're there to do. You face the fact that you're not working there 40 hours a week doing that. And taxing is one way to put it, but mostly it's the effort and endurance it takes to keep your focus.
Yeah.
To not allow the voices that say, oh my God, I'm phoning it in or whatever. And then once you've trained yourself, honestly, I don't think I could phone it in if I tried, because you click the on button and then I do my thing. I don't know how to do it halfway. I wouldn't even know how to do it halfway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's funny. I was talking to a musician the other day and I was mentioning to him that it's like when you spend so much time around great musicians, you sort of maybe lose perspective as to what other people would say, like, oh wow, that's really impressive, or that's a lot of work. And it's like, well, no, that's just what I do. It's just, you know, it's sort of, there's this level of like expected proficiency that I think it's really cool to see people who are really incredible at their craft just being able to operate on a high level naturally after a long time.
Right. Yes. And you take for granted that after a while, because when I go to work, everyone is good. I remember thinking that when I was young, first going into the booth, I'm talking about commercials, and I would read group reads with other people or people who I'd seen on TV when I was a kid, and I remember thinking how great they were, because I'd read the words on the page, and then I see what they would do with it and be like, oh, wow, that's impressive. And then, of course, you learn. Smart actors learn and steal from the people that they work with. That's where you get your ideas. That's where taking acting class is so important, because in acting class, you can watch what other people do and see the lessons they learn and figure out how to apply that to what you do. That's why I always take acting class. Even though I'm doing voiceovers and behavior and what you do with your body has nothing to do with a performance in voiceovers, aside from gesturing and not holding your performance in, but I mean, you know, behavior like you would in a scene, is because you want to get as many ideas as possible. Keep yourself artistically fresh, and how you do that in the performing arts is to see what other people are doing.
Yeah. Man, well, this has been a really awesome conversation. I think it's given people a lot to chew on and maybe a little bit of insight into a world that they, you know, didn't know a lot about. And I know that before I really started digging into it, I didn't know a lot about it, because it is, like you said, invisible.
Hidden.
So,
yeah.
Man, again, I really appreciate you taking the time.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
Huge thanks to Steve for coming on the show. It's kind of crazy. I grew up watching some of the animes that he's been in and other things like that, and it's just really interesting to find out more about the voice behind those images. It's so fascinating to me that oftentimes we don't really make that connection that, oh yeah, there's a person who has to do that. That's a job. And not only is that a job, but it's a really, really cool job. So once again, huge thanks to Steve.
Unfortunately, I turned off the recorder for this interview, and then somehow we just got talking and sat down for another 20 or 30 minutes just talking about voiceover and the life of an actor. And then also Disneyland. It turns out he's a huge fan as well. So, man, props to Steve for being a really cool guy. You know, this is just a lesson to me to keep the recorder running. As promised, we're now going to be hearing one of Steve's voiceover demos. This is actually his animation demo, so it's meant specifically for cartoons, anime, and that sort of thing. This will be a sort of cycle of a bunch of different characters and emotions, all a really broad range, but in a really short amount of time, just to give you a brief overview of the types of things that Steve can do. As always, please rate, comment, and subscribe. It takes just a short amount of time, and it really, really does help us out. I want to try and get these incredible interviews to as many people as possible. Also, remember that you can head to our website, createcastpod.com, for more exclusive content. Once again, I'm your host, Chase Kay. And now, we have Steve Staley's animation voiceover demo.
All communications from here on out are to be point cast only. Kill all lights. Switch over to laser sensors and infrared on your monitors.
Ah, my, yes. Young, oh, do come in, of course, do come in. Well, what brings you here?
I will destroy you, human!
I did it, didn't I? Even here on the ground. One enemy down. Now to get back home.
Captain, we're going at warp 10. If we go any faster... Oh my.
Calm down. Relax. Clumsy pilots have clumsy ways of fighting. Now quit wandering and get into my sights.
To fight.
You were right, Rico. The cocoon was surprisingly warm.
Oh, Mitch, hey, you look good. Oh, yeah, the pumps really make the outfit.
In fact, I know by heart Cotton Mather's account of witchcraft, and many a ghost have I myself seen on a lonely night, Herr Von Ripper. Oh, yes, indeed. I got greased, man. In fact, you know, they chased me right out of the park, labeled me a lap dog, a poochie non grata. Does that sound familiar? Well, pardonnez moi. Guess I must have got me confused on Gay Paris downtown. That doesn't make a bit of sense.